let's talk about the sort of city we actually want to live in, and you know how it could be nicer and not full of, you know, rush hour traffic, which is choking kids on their way to school.
Welcome to Calling All Stations, the transport podcast. I'm Christian Wolmar, an author and journalist who has covered transport for the past 30 years. In every episode, we try to keep you up to date with the most engaging news stories, policy developments, and interviews in the transport world. And with me is my regular co-presenter, Mark Walker, who has spent decades looking at transport policies and legislation. So, Mark, what are we covering today?
Hello, Christian, and hello to our listeners. We have interviews with two Simons today, both of them with some very topical insights. So first of all, we'll be hearing from Simon Weller, who's the Assistant General Secretary of the Train Drivers Union, ASLEF, on the current state of the industrial disputes affecting a number of train operators in England and the possibility of their resolution. We'll also be hearing from Simon Pirani, who you've interviewed in connection with a campaign called Fare Free London, which is designed to, as the name implies, see the abolition of public transport fares across the capital and the replacement with a free service. And we'll, in the midst of all of that, we'll also take a brief look at where Great Britain is with its rail reform programme. And at the end, we'll examine the breaking news, the very sad news from Baltimore about the bridge collapse in the harbour there following a collision by a large container shipping vessel.
Right, Mark. Well, we'll start off with my interview with Simon Weller, which I think listeners will find is very instructive and brings us up to date with what's happening on the industrial relations front on the railways. Well, it's been some time since we've discussed the industrial action on the railways on this podcast. So we thought we'd have a catch up with Simon Weller, who's the Deputy General Secretary of ASLEF, and see where we're at, given that there are, I think, Simon, some more strikes in the offing.
Yeah, that's correct. And where we're at is pretty much where we were in April last year. So a year on, they've not deigned to meet us, which is a bit of a problem, they being the DfT, Hugh Merriman and Mark Harper.
So where's going to be the action this time? Or the inaction, as it were?
It's going to be in about a fortnight. It'll be spread across a number of companies. It's over the weekend of the 5th, 6th, 7th of April.
And will that mean a total shutdown of these lines, or will it mean that some trains will run, or what? How's it looking?
Broadly, it will be a total shutdown where they have managers that they press into service. LNER is a good example. Where they get all their managers to drive trains on the strike day so they can provide a skeleton service. But the others, the kind of the southern region companies and the northwest, northern companies, there will be a complete shutdown. There won't be any minimum service level trains.
So when you say you haven't talked to ministers, I mean, do you talk to the train operators at all?
Yeah, the train operators are just as frustrated. The train operators are our employers, and directly the trade dispute is with them. We have said to the DfT, well, take the shackles off the employers and we can negotiate with them. But the DfT have said, no, we want reform. They put out a reform package that was not what we were negotiating in April. It was an absolute shock to us that the package we received at 7 o'clock the following morning bore no relation to what we had negotiated the day before. But this had been a DfT imposition. But it was a one-size-fits-all that doesn't fit 16 companies. So we rejected it and said, this just does not work for all the reasons in the discussion. And then they've just gone to ground since April last year, which is a real, real problem.
I do remember meeting you at the time and you telling me precisely this. Can you maybe give us a little bit of detail? I mean, you know, obviously passengers are frustrated at this. Rail enthusiasts and supporters like us on the Calling All Stations podcast, we're frustrated by it. I mean, you know, couldn't you find some room for compromise here? I mean, is this absolutely kind of something you can't negotiate on?
Well, no, there's absolute room for compromise. We had negotiated what we thought was a good package. You know, I'm frustrated. I was a train driver for 20 years before I took this full-time position. You know, I'm a lifelong supporter of the railway, and we were prepared to compromise. Aslef's history has always been compromised since, you know, since privatisation, certainly. We've always, you know, we've given flexibility, we've negotiated, we've seen a third way through. But this time they were saying to us, take it or leave it. And so we said, well, I'll tell you what, we'll leave it. But then...
Oh, well, OK, give me possibly an example of the sort of thing that they're asking and that you find impossible to agree to.
Well, compulsory Sundays. So at the moment, for a number of the companies, Sundays are outside the working week. So they're effectively overtime. And what they're seeking is you are then compelled to work Sundays. Fine, but that affects our average working week, which would normally be 35 hours. But if you bung in 17 Sundays a year, that suddenly shifts it up to what we work normally. Now, some companies already have Sundays in the working week. We've negotiated this. And we say we can't just impose this. This needs to be the same as we've had before in other companies. We're prepared to discuss this. It's not popular with our members, but we're prepared to discuss it. And have a similar system in place to where the companies that have Sundays in the working week, they go, no, we want commitment and compulsion to work Sundays. And we said, well, that's not going to happen. But the problem is these 16 companies, some have got Sundays in the working week and some haven't. So this 4%, this measly 4% that was at a time when inflation was running at 10%, is for all this productivity of having Sundays in the working week. But some of the companies have already got it. So they're getting a pay rise that other people are paying for through productivity. That's why it was rejected. But the DfT just can't seem to get their head round that.
So you're basically saying that they're treating all the companies the same, even though you have different starting positions.
Absolutely. Every company has different terms and conditions and different salaries. And fine, we'll have the negotiations to bring in the changes they want, but it's all different. So we're going to have to do it on a company-by-company basis. You can't have a one-size-fits-all. And that's what they're trying to implement. And it's not just Sundays in the working week. There are other issues about the rostering and how they apply that, training, all this kind of stuff. There's a long list of issues, some of them quite arcane and quite frankly, quite boring. But the problem is these operators all have different needs. You know, the long distance intercity operators have completely different needs to the interurban metro services, which then have different needs to the rural northern Merseyside type inter, you know, Liverpool, Manchester, or the cross Pennine commutes. They're all different, and they don't seem to be able to grasp that.
So, apart from this Sunday working, are there other red lines that you absolutely don't want crossed? I mean, I realise you don't want to give your negotiation position.
No. But I think one of the other ones that they kept reintroducing was basically trainee drivers paying for their own training. And we're just saying, no, that's just wrong. Because I started as a teenager with British Rail, and then British Rail trained me to be a train driver. I passed for driving when I was 21. And that, you know, whilst we all moan about the railway, that was a good job. I managed to buy a house, bring up a family, and I want that opportunity for other young people to have. But if you're going to have to pay for your own training, then that kind of denies it. It's only those who can rely on the bank of mum and dad or have their own kind of other ways of doing this. And that's just wrong.
So, well, I suppose they get that from the aviation industry, where pilots do essentially pay for their own training.
Yeah, and there's not many young kids or people from black and ethnic backgrounds or women who are becoming pilots. You know, this is, we want to change the demographic of train drivers, because pretty much train drivers are white middle-aged blokes, probably a little bit overweight. But you know, that's what I see is the 40, 50 somethings, and they're all male and white.
I take your point, and also I suppose that train driving is not really a transferable skill. You can't sort of, you know, with a pilot, you can go from EasyJet to Ryanair if you're operating the same aeroplane. Whereas with train driving, you can't really take those skills to somewhere else.
Not unless you really want to move house. You know, there's very few of the operators, possibly Avanti West Coast and West Midlands Trains. You could cross the platform at Birmingham and maybe at Euston. But the rest of it is kind of, they are regional operators and you're going to have to move house.
Okay, so where do you see, you know, we railway supporters, as I say, we're kind of exhausted by this.
You're not the only ones.
Okay, but do you see any conceivable? I mean, what do you do? You announce these strike actions, and is there any reaction from Harper and his merry men, or is it just they ignore you, or what? I mean, or do they just say we've made you an offer and that's it?
Well, that's what they were doing up until the minimum service levels came in. I think they were dragging their feet until they'd got the minimum service level regulations in place, because they, I think, believed this, whilst they weren't saying this, believed it to be a silver bullet. And then we would, that would us, that would be all over for us left, and we'd have to capitulate. Well, we demonstrated at the last round of strikes that minimum service levels, as we had always said, were completely not able to operate. They were far too complex, and they just didn't have the resources to deliver it. And once we demonstrated that, I think there is now some movement. I know our members are becoming increasingly frustrated with the lack of action from Hugh Merriman and Mark Harper. Merriman himself announced in the House of Commons last week that he was going to be meeting Mick Whelan, but this was over statements he had made, Hugh Merriman, to the Transport Select Committee about the separate dispute on LNER, which is completely outside the pay. But Mick Whelan, General Secretary of ASLEF, will be meeting Hugh Merriman on that. And I think, you know, well, once we've started meeting on other areas, then I'm hopeful perhaps there may be some movement, that they may realise that, you know, the MSLs didn't work. They are going to have to talk to us.
And the minimum service levels.
The only way we're going to get a resolution is by talking. The only way we're going to get a resolution is by some form of compromise. And compromise is not just by one party. Compromise is also, you know, they have to compromise as well. But the only way we're going to get that is if we're in the same room talking. And so far, we've not had a request to come and talk, even though we've been saying we're more than happy, pick up the phone, set up a date, we can phone, you know, but we're waiting for that. But I'm hopeful that there may be some movement, but we don't know yet.
Okay. So could one, I mean, one of the things that the public says, of course, is, oh, train drivers already paid a lot of money. And indeed, I think that the basic is about 65,000, 66,000 a year. Perhaps you can confirm that. So not be possible to sort of take that out of play? Say, well, okay, we're not really interested in pay here, but we want to sort out the rest.
Firstly, if you want a market economy, you pay the market rate. And the market rate for a train driver is around £55,000-£60,000. That's the market rate. The problem the employers have is they're very short of train drivers. So the problem is they're struggling to retain, they're struggling to recruit. And we're also, the demographic of train drivers, as I was saying earlier, are kind of broadly 40s and 50s. Based on our membership data, we represent 97% of train drivers in the UK are a member of ASLEF. So our membership database is a pretty good reflection of the makeup of train drivers. 22% of our members, this is in England, on the companies that we're in dispute with, are due to retire in the next 5 years. That's a fifth of your driving workforce are due to retire. 43% are over 50, with a normal retirement age of 60, 62. That's nearly half of your drivers are going to go in the next decade. They can barely recruit and train to stand still at the moment. And this is before we've got to this cliff edge. So it's sort of a classic piece of sort of capital in its supply and demand. But we need to have the discussions about how we're going to deal with that. And we've been saying, you know, you are facing this cliff edge. The employers, the ones that we speak to, know that they're facing this cliff edge. Railway recruitment has been cyclical, but it's been compounded of late. But the DfT, who was supposed to be sort of setting direction for the railway, and God knows where this guiding mind of Great British Railways is, but you know, we need to sort this out. So yes, we're really keen on having negotiations and discussions over this.
Okay, so last point. The cavalry is over the hill. Labour are kind of charging down at a great pace. Will all the problems be solved as soon as a Labour government gets in?
I would like to say yes, that's going to be the case. But the problem is now, we're not going to see a Labour government potentially for another, 10 months, 12 months?
Well, six. No, come on, Simon. Let's be a bit optimistic. 6 months.
All right. What madness is going to go on between now and November? But I want to get this resolved now because the damage has been done to the railway now. And the morale of drivers is falling now. And this is kind of, we need to get this sorted out now. Waiting for a Labour government to come and sort it all out, they've got a lot of other bigger fish to fry than the railways at the moment. So I would really want to get it sorted out. You know, maybe Mark Harper and Hugh Merriman can demonstrate that we aren't dealing with a zombie government and they can get this resolved. I'd rather get this sorted out sooner rather than later.
Okay, well, on that slightly optimistic note, and on the, I have noted the fact that you said at least there are possibly some discussions starting, albeit on other matters. Thank you very much for coming on, Simon, and updating us on that. And, you know, let's hope that your optimism bears fruit. Thank you.
It's from a very low bar, though, my optimism. So get carried away.
I think as we would have hoped for, and as our listeners would have hoped for, Christian, your interview with Simon Weller has taken a much deeper examination of the issues behind the dispute between ASLEF, the Train Drivers Union, and a number of train operators in England. And of course, sitting behind that, the UK Department for Transport and the ministerial team. Would you feel that with the insights we had from Simon and the detail there, that perhaps there might be a little bit of room for optimism that this all might be resolved?
I thought there was a hint of that. I mean, he was trying to kill it off at the end, so don't be too optimistic. But there does seem to be a slight movement. I must say, I do think there's a difference between the two ministers. I think Hugh Merriman, who knows the industry quite well, I think is desperate to get things moving. And I think Mark Harper, who has shown really that he's above all a political animal with the stuff that he said about 15-minute cities at the party conference and the war on motoring, which he's kind of trying to counter and saying, I'm on the side of drivers. I think he's really in it for the populist causes, whereas Hugh Merriman, when I meet him and talk to him, really does sound quite reasonable and wants to get it resolved. But, you know, all this is it's a state of limbo in the rail industry, and given, of course, the fact that the reform hasn't got off the ground, as the recent National Audit Office report kind of highlighted.
Yes, we've had some developments since we examined the rail reform programme in some detail in episode 15 of this series. Now, we did that following the publication on the 20th of February of the UK government's draft rail reform bill. And I should say, Christian, we've had some really nice feedback from listeners from that episode who have thanked us for the sort of spotlight that we shone into some of the murkier
corners.
Trying
to pave our way through some very difficult stuff. Yes,
indeed.
Yes, you did with great expertise
of that of that process. So since then, since that episode, we've had, as was expected, the House of Commons Transport Committee launched on the 28th of February its call for evidence as part of the process of pre-legislative scrutiny of the draft rail reform bill. This is such a mouthful of technical terms, but that call for evidence was open for a month. As we record this, it's just about to close. And then once those written submissions have been received and looked at by the clerks and advisors at the House of Commons Transport Committee, there'll then be a series of evidence hearings where various organisations, leaders from the industry, and ultimately senior civil servants and ministers are brought in to explain what the legislation is designed to achieve and whether it is fit for purpose. So we'll, I'm sure on Calling All Stations, we'll be covering that in some detail. We've also had on the 8th of March, the National Audit Office published its the results of its investigation into the rail transformation programme, as the Department for Transport likes to call this process that the rail industry in Great Britain is going through. It's the National Audit Office essentially is a kind of arm's length organisation that scrutinises the way in which all of our money, public money, taxpayers' money, is spent by the British state. And it's fair to say that the press release, the headlines from this National Audit Office report are pretty scathing. As you pointed out, Christian, in your articles in Rail Magazine, the criticism in of the rail reform programme, the rail transformation programme from the National Audit Office is pretty scathing. But I just thought I'd read out a couple of really interesting paragraphs from this for the benefit of our listeners. So the NAO report found governance arrangements for the programme had been complex and ineffective. Reviews by the Infrastructure and Projects Authority and the DfT in early 2023 reported that governance was confused, accountabilities unclear, and there was not agreement across stakeholders on the scope and delivery approach of the programme. Really importantly, it says DfT and HMT, the Treasury, had disagreed on areas of reform from the start, such as the remit of Great British Railways. DfT changed its delivery and governance approach as part of implementing interim arrangements during autumn 2023. So there we have, real revealed to public gaze, the disagreement at the heart of government over whether this was the right reform programme at all. And then just to sort of finish off the update for our listeners, on the 22nd of March, another parliamentary committee, Public Accounts Committee, the PAC, which takes these recommendations and reports from the National Audit Office and investigates them further, they announced their own inquiry on the 22nd of March. So they've issued their own call for evidence on the findings of the NAO. So we now have two big parliamentary inquiries going on into the rail reform process and, of course, no actual reform.
Well, one could say that was all what you read out was bureaucratic language for really what football supporters talk about refs at the games I go to, which is they don't know what they're doing. And then that chant goes out regularly at football matches. And clearly that was a bureaucratic way of saying, they have absolutely no idea of what they're trying to do. And I mean, it's just, we can laugh about it, Mark, but it is pretty bad for the railways that there is so much uncertainty. And I'm sure you encounter this when you talk to senior managers in the railways. They are in despair over this. I mean, they just want this sorted out and some sort of future mapped out. But clearly, we're not going to get anything really until we get a new government and they begin to get a grips with it.
Here's a big change of subject matter. Christian has interviewed Simon Pirani, who runs a campaign called Fare Free London, which is looking at how it might be possible to introduce free public transport across the capital. Here's Christian's interview.
I've seen that there is a campaign to have free urban transport in London. And I thought that I'd like to find out more about that. And so I decided to have a chat with Simon Pirani, who's actually one of the people behind this campaign. and is an honorary professor at the Durham University, and is also, you've written a book, Simon, about fossil fuel, haven't you?
Yes, Christian. Yes, thanks for having me on. So this campaign has grown in a way out of the campaign that we did against the Silvertown Tunnel project here in southeast and east London. We've been banging on about that for 4 or 5 years now. And I did get involved partly because of the book that you mentioned, which is about the history of fossil fuel consumption. And obviously, climate change and the need to reduce emissions was a big theme there. And so I got involved in the campaign since this is an issue right on my doorstep here in Greenwich. We've tried to lobby the mayor about that. We've had enormous support. The Newham Council, the Greenwich Council, the local MPs, everybody has declared their opposition to that project, but nevertheless, it's gone ahead.
This is a road tunnel that sort of parallels Blackwall Tunnel, isn't it? And
exactly.
It was promoted, oddly enough, by the Labour mayor, Sadiq Khan, despite his green policies.
That's right. And it's going to be a few metres east of the Blackwall Tunnel. Unfortunately, the mayor hasn't listened to all that lobbying. And we continue to suggest, as does Newham, as does Greenwich, that alternative uses for the tunnel are looked at. That is, not cars and lorries, but say active travel, some kind of public transport going through that tunnel. But we have to admit that our main hope, which was to stop the thing happening, hasn't been realised. And that's not the first campaign that any of us have been involved in where we haven't succeeded in our aims. But we thought that we didn't want to let that energy and goodwill that we'd accumulated over all that time dissipate. And so the meeting that we held to launch a campaign on free public transport was initiated by the Stop the Silvertown Tunnel Coalition. That was last month. Now, various other organizations and people have joined us on that. There was a lot of enthusiasm. So we've put out a campaign briefing, which was supported by the new organization, Fair Free London, by the Stop the Silvertown Tunnel Coalition, by the Greener Jobs Alliance, and by Tipping Point, which is a campaign group that tries to link climate and social justice issues. And the central point really is that is twofold. Firstly, free public transport opens the city to everybody. It's an enormous liberatory thing. And we've had meetings where people have said, the day that I got my pass from Transport for London, for
the freedom pass
was truly a day of freedom for me. And we've got also, we know the effect of the pass for the 16 to 17 year olds, the zip pass, free buses has been overwhelming. So it's a social justice issue. And it seems from looking at the past examples that you can never go wrong with it as a social justice issue.
So this has come out of the fact that the Silvertown Tunnel is all but built and will open, I think, in a year or so. And so, oddly, this has been a kind of side kind of step to take on a wider issue around free transport.
That's right. And that brings me to the second point, which is that we've spent a lot of time thinking about, while we've been campaigning about the Silvertown Tunnel, what could you really do that will be bold and demonstrative about the appalling level of air pollution that we still have in London and about London's climate targets. And that's another thing that's drawn us to this idea. There's a lot of policies that we hear about which are nibbling at the edges of these big and very frightening problems. So for a big city to say, look, we really need to be serious. And I mean, look at the political atmosphere we're working in, where the government has just chucked away every single promise it's made about action on climate. So what would be the effect of a big city saying, we're not going to follow the trend, we're not going to follow the government, we're going to go in the opposite direction, And as well as, yes, asking people to get out of their cars when they can, we will also say, yes, get out of your cars, but we're going to invest heavily in public transport. We're going to provide public transport which can get you to where you want to go, and we're going to make it free. I mean, that would be a really powerful combination of policies.
Okay, I take that. Well, there are some places in the world that have already done this, aren't they? They're listed in your excellent pamphlet, which I did actually read. There's quite a few places like Montpellier, I think, and Estonia and Luxembourg, one or two others, isn't there?
That's right. And I've looked at the experience from there. The two biggest cities in Europe that are operating this policy at the moment are Luxembourg and Tallinn, which is the capital of Estonia. In the case of Luxembourg, the free public transport was introduced in 2020. There was an announcement from the municipal authority there just recently that the initial 3-year period, the result is 11% drop in traffic volumes and 25% increase in public transport use. Now, Luxembourg's not typical. I think it's the richest city in Europe, certainly one of the richest. Then if we look at Tallinn, the results are different. So the zero fares has been in operation since 2013. It was not introduced in an ideal way. It was introduced in the middle of an election campaign for the mayor's job by the sitting mayor. He did it very quickly. He did it without consulting with the transport policy people in his own office. The fares were already low, typical for a post-Soviet country, and there were no additional traffic control measures, no real kind of preparation. Now, there has been a social justice effect. It's been good because Tallinn is not a very rich city like Luxembourg, so it has helped people to get on the bus to go where they need to go. It has not made a difference to the level of traffic. And I think that the research I've seen on that says you need to integrate it with other transport policies. Now, we do have other examples going much further back. There's a town in France, Aubagne, which introduced free public transport in 2009. It's been a great success. It was conceived as a social policy. It's funded mainly by a payroll tax on companies in the town that have more than, I think, 11 employees. It's been a great success story. And then if we go further back, I mean, of course, London itself has experience from the 1980s, not of free public transport, although that idea was originally discussed in the Labour Party, which controlled the GLC.
It was Ken Livingstone's Fares Fair thing, yes.
That's right.
I'm old enough to remember that too.
Right, so am I. And what we both probably remember is it did result in a big increase in the use of public transport and a reduction in traffic. Unfortunately, the whole thing ended in the drama in the High Court. The policy couldn't be continued in the way it had been envisaged, but there was nothing wrong with it.
But it did result in a simplification of the system and the zone levels and some ultimate reduction. But okay, I have some issues with this, Simon. I mean, first of all those towns that you're mentioning there are much smaller. I mean, it hasn't been tried on the scale of a city like London. And indeed, you know, the amount of revenue you're talking about here, I think there's something like 4 or 5 billion of revenue annually, which you're going to forego with this. That's an enormous amount of money. How do you justify that? And how would you manage to pay for it?
You're right. Four billion is 22-23 accounts for Transport for London. That was the fare income. So, yes, we're talking about £4 or 5 billion. Now, the first point is that obviously the situation got complicated in the pandemic. The government put a great deal of money into TfL to keep it ticking over when we were all at home and not using public transport. So pre-pandemic, London, roughly, you know, talking in round figures, got 70% of the income for the public transport system from fares. In Paris, it's 26%, and in New York, it's 38%. I mean, there's no reason for it to be high, except, well, the reason that you and I know, which is that the mayor has deliberately kept it high because of the long-term friction since we've had the Labour mayor between the mayor and central government. I mean, hopefully an election may take place this year which would change that situation. And there's no denying that national government is part of this picture. But now the other point is to come back. You say £4-5 billion is a lot of money. Well, it's an awful lot of money to you and me, an awful lot of money to people who are listening to this conversation. But in terms of financing a public service in a large city, it is not a big sum of money. In Paris, the payroll tax is the number one source of finance for the public transport system. So every company that employs more than 11 people has to pay, I think it's 1.5% or some very small number proportion of the wages that it pays to each employee. And that goes into the city treasury. And that's how they finance the public transport system. Another one which would be very suitable for London, because I mean, London is awash with money if we look on the big scale of things. Another one which would be very suitable for London would be land value capture. That's what they use in Hong Kong quite effectively. And in fact, the Elizabeth Line is partly financed by that with the community infrastructure levy, so that basically you skim off the fact that a business which is opened, and this has happened here in Woolwich where I live, with the opening of the Elizabeth Line station. So businesses open bang on top of the Elizabeth Line, which, 20 minutes from Tottenham Court Road, which for us in Woolwich is just incredible, probably 30 minutes. And that raised 600 million quid for the Elizabeth Line. But I've seen reports from, I think it was the Centre for Cities, which suggest that you could raise 10 or even tens of times more than that 600 million by an effective use of that method.
Yeah, but so there's a problem there that this land value increase has happened, and now trying to tax it retrospectively would be very difficult.
Yes, I mean, life is difficult. I don't know all the answers to raising taxes. I know that if both London government and national government were to put their mind to it, we could find a solution. So I'm not suggesting it's easy. I'm not suggesting I have a kind of magic method. And indeed, I don't really feel it's my place or the place of campaigners to say, well, look, this is how you should organise the whole tax system. I mean, the point is the tax system should be organised to provide the public services we want to provide. And okay, what we want to do is shift the mindset and say that this is a public service that should be provided free.
OK, but as your pamphlet actually says, under 10s, over 60s, a few other groups actually already get free transport. So effectively, what you're saying is that you should open it up for free to the group, I suppose, largely between teenagers and 60, and that we should basically give them this enormous boost of free transport. And I presume you're only talking about urban transport in London here, but is that actual social justice? Because they're not necessarily the poorest group of people.
Well, look, the poorest group of people go across all age groups. Writing the campaign briefing that you've mentioned, I actually looked up, I'm not a social policy expert of any kind, and I looked up the research on poverty, and I must say I was shocked by the level of poverty in London. London has a greater proportion of people under the poverty line, as it's calculated by the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, than anywhere, any other region in the country except for northeast of England. It's shocking. And of course, in the northeast of England, you may expect that your neighbours or the other people you're interacting with on a daily basis may also be of low income. What people in London of the lowest incomes have, they're surrounded by the Canary Wharfs, by the skyscrapers that are owned by billionaires from other countries as tax avoidance measures. They're surrounded by this incredible wealth, which of course exacerbates the problem. So I don't at all think that this policy, which would, those 20-somethings, 30-somethings who are in precarious employment or no employment, those single-parent families who, by the way, don't have a car. I mean, the other thing that is very noticeable in the inner London area, according to TfL, in the inner London area, if you have less than £50,000 a year coming into your household, you're more than likely not going to have a car. So those are the people that this would benefit and support. And certainly all the organizations who've looked at this, Transport for Quality of Life did a whole briefing on this. I don't think there's anything to lose from a social justice point of view. And I think that the, you know, if there are people working and if they have cars, I mean, they could pay more into the treasury through their car ownership. So a key point we've made in the briefing, and again, if the mayor comes back to us and says, well, this is going to need support from national government, I agree. And one of the first things national government could do is to unfreeze the fuel duty. I mean, the Office of Budget Responsibility says that that freeze of fuel duty has cost the national treasury, the government treasury, £80 billion.
Yes, I saw that figure came out yesterday, actually. Actually, I think it was 90, Simon.
Oh, well, it's probably gone up because I haven't seen yesterday's figures.
Yeah, no, yesterday they said it was £90 billion that it's cost, yes. Which is ludicrous. Okay, so you think it's feasible financially, that it's useful socially. Don't you think, though, there would be an issue with lots of people hanging around on the public transport system that all day long, that it would, you know, there'd be a social kind of disorder issue about this, because you know, people would see this as it's free, and there is a tendency when you see things as free and communal not to regard them as much as when you pay for things. I know that's a kind of unfortunate human trait, but there is evidence for that.
So I was speaking to some friends in the States on Zoom a couple of weeks ago, and I was telling them about this. And one of them said, and I'm afraid I've forgotten the place that he mentioned, but he said that there'd been a town in the States where free public transport had been introduced. And indeed, that town had a big homeless issue. And many of the homeless people who had previously been sleeping on the street decided to go and curl up in the corner somewhere in the city's metro system. Now, that's a homeless problem. That's a problem of poverty. That's a problem of people being left behind by neoliberal policies, which are even more probably extreme in the USA than here. We shouldn't have a homeless problem in one of the biggest and richest cities in the world. And if we do, let's address it. There's another problem. And so, again, I mean, I've read into this, and I am not going to recommend a policy as though it's a kind of magic bullet and it's free of problems. So there's research from a town in the Czech Republic, for example. And what they found was, as soon as they did this, people who otherwise might have gone by bike or walked used the public transport system. So that's another issue. But then that, again, is an issue of the broader transport policy. I mean, we get enough press releases from the mayor's office talking about active travel and so on. I mean, if there was some real encouragement of active travel, and of course, I mean, certainly in this part of London, some proper bike lanes where you don't take your life into your hands by using the bike lane, we could counter those sort of tendencies. And we've been very pleased to get support straight away from trade union activists in the transport system for this idea. Three or four of them came to our meeting, which we held at the Waterloo Action Centre, and they've since gone and one of the RMT branches on the underground passed a motion saying they welcomed this initiative. And of course, according to a friend of mine who drove a bus for many years, one of the horrible parts of the job is, you know, arguing with that young mum who's just gone shopping and is getting on the bus and finds that she's 50p short of the fare, or you know, now the card doesn't work, whatever it is. Now, of course, this idea would take away that horrible friction and that horrible kind of policing job that people have to do. And so I was talking to that same friend, and he said, well, yeah, but what about if you get a load of rowdy teenagers on the bus? Well, it can be an extension of the Oyster card, you know, which you want anyway. From a transport planning point of view, you want to know who's going where the system's getting used most heavily, where the additional investment is needed, and so on. So you need all that information.
So would you allow tourists, for example? Would tourists get a free travel?
Well, that's a great question, Christian, and it came up when we had our meeting there was one person who was very, anyway, the campaign doesn't have a party line on that. There was one person who was militantly for collecting as much revenue as we could from those tourists. There were others who took a more lenient point of view. But again, I mean, these are things, you know, a big policy shift like this, you'd have to sort that out as you went along.
Okay. So as a last question, Simon, look, this has been an absolutely fascinating discussion. What's the next steps? I mean, is there any realistic chance of this? I mean, you know, this is a kind of slightly left field campaign, as it were. So is there any realistic chance of influencing the powers that be on this, and what are your next steps about the campaign?
So I can't really answer the thing about the chances of influencing the powers that be. I mean, if you're old enough to remember the episode with Ken Livingstone and the Fares Fair, you're certainly also old enough to remember the poll tax episode. We did end up with the council tax instead of the poll tax. But I mean, the initial idea of basically charging people because they were people, you know, a charge on your head was removed. And that was popularized by a very big kind of popular campaign, which I mean, I remember when I first heard about it, and I thought, what even is this poll tax? Why is everybody getting so disturbed about it? So I think campaigns can shift public opinion. And I'm quite kind of optimistic that this is, and again, I mean, we talked about the historical experience. This has happened before. There's examples in Brazil, where there was a town, Marica, in Brazil, where the private transport operators actually operated something of a monopoly and were gouging up the fares. And the public authority kept its nerve and said, right, okay, guys, we're going to have some free public transport here. See how you like that. And they used it as a kind of public service thing, and it had huge public support. So I think it can shift the public mood. I've campaigned about a lot of things, and very often we're kind of campaigning defensively. You know, stop doing this. Stop, you know, closing workplaces and throwing people on the dole. Stop bombing people over the other side of the world who aren't hurting us, whatever it is. What I like about this is opening up a positive vision for the future. And let's talk about the sort of city we actually want to live in, and, you know, how it could be nicer and not full of, you know, rush hour traffic, which is choking kids on their way to school. Now, as for the next steps of the campaign, I mean, that's not really a question to me. We've got an organizing group of Fare Free London, which was elected at this meeting. We've got the campaign briefing out. We've been over to City Hall and let them know that we're here. We had a very good response, as you might expect, from the Green Party and from some Labour Party people. So obviously we're going to work on that. But I mean, that organising group will go and think what to do next, and has already said to people, look, in your localities, go and talk about this in your organizations, whether it's community organizations, environmentalist groups, trade unions, whatever. And, you know, we'll get feedback from people. And I mean, I hope it'll grow, and that I'll have more to tell you the next time we speak.
Okay. Oh, well, that's great, Simon. And thank you. Well, you know, all power to your elbow. I think I like the fact you're talking about a positive vision rather than being on the defensive. I think that's a great start for the campaign. So I wish you every luck with it. So thank you very much for coming on Calling All Stations podcast.
And thank you for having me.
Here's Christian's final thought from the departure lounge.
Well, we're recording this on the morning after the terrible bridge disaster in Baltimore in the eastern United States. And it reminded me of the fact that at one point, there was a proposal, and it was one of three or four proposals for the Channel crossing, to have a similar arrangement. In fact, it was going to be, I think, tunnels at both ends of the coast, but also then a bridge in the middle for a long stretch. And this was immediately ruled out of any real consideration because of the risk on one of the world's busiest seaways. And at the time, I remember people saying, oh, no, that's just ridiculous. The risk is tiny and so on. But I think this accident, this terrible accident, which clearly will have had some fatalities and is absolutely awful to look at because they've got footage of the bridge collapsing. I think this will demonstrate once and for all why we didn't have a bridge over the channel, and we're never going to have one.
Calling All Stations, the transport podcast with Christian Walmar, is produced by Cogitamus Limited, a leading provider of public affairs consultancy services in the sector. We hope you've enjoyed this episode. If you have, please consider giving us a 5-star rating with whichever platform you use. Do also follow us on X, formerly known as Twitter. Our handle is @AllStationsPod.